This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the casebook of a crime psychiatrist, title of the new book by tonight's guest, Dr. James Brussel, Assistant Commissioner of Mental Hygiene for the State of New York. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-3357. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Dr. Brussel is not a detective, but a psychiatrist who has the unique ability to study a crime committed and from the nature of the crime, reconstruct the criminal, his nature, his appearance, and even his personal idiosyncrasies. He is affectionately called the psychiatrist as a Sherlock Holmes, whose extraordinary deductions have helped the police solve some of the most bizarre criminal cases of our time. What sort of man should the police look for? What kind of work might he be doing? Where might he be found? These are some of the questions Dr. Brussel, the author of Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist, has answered with frightening clarity. Dr. Brussel helped solve such notorious crimes as that of the Mad Bomber, the Wiley murders, the Boston Strangler, and the Coppolino case. He's the Assistant Commissioner of Mental Hygiene for the State of New York, and his services have been called on frequently by various police departments, the FBI, and even the Central Intelligence Agency for Counterespionage Advice. Dr. Brussel is standing by in New York City to answer your questions on criminal psychiatry and the criminal. Dr. Brussel, good evening, sir.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir, and thank you for being with us.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Dr. Brussel, how do you go about identifying the criminal from the crime?
I think it can be best illustrated by taking the case of the Mad Bomber, in which I had only three clues. These were the bombs, that is, pictures of the bombs reconstructed and the damage they did. They never killed anyone, nor did he have any intention of killing anyone. His letters, and a fact that had been rather ignored, in which he took a knife to slice the underside of seats in a motion picture house in which he implanted his bombs. The first bomb was set on November 16th, 1940. It was a small thing, and they gradually increased in size until 1942, when he stopped and said with a note, he wrote in a note, quote, "I will make no more bomb units for the duration of the war. My patriotic feelings have made me decide this. Later, I will bring the Con Edison to justice. They will pay for their dastardly deed," signed FP, which later we learned meant fair play. Now, he did desist from the setting the bombs from 1942 to 1946, and he did support the war effort because he was in the service. This much, of course, I deduced. I felt that he learned to make better bombs, which was evidenced by that fact from 46 to 56 when I came in the case, and I said he was in ordnance. I was somewhat off. He was next door learning to be electrician. But it was his letters, which he wrote to various newspapers, 16 in all between 1941 and 46, and he wrote them also to Con Edison, in which he used such words as ghoulish acts, psychopath, ill health, and I had the feeling that these, coupled with the Con Edison, was the type of stilted English you see taught to a foreigner in a country other than our own. And I felt that this man either had come over here as a youngster or his folks had preceded him by just that one generation. Now, since he had the same gripe over a period of 16 years, a persecutory idea that he never changed, it was well systematized in that his ill health was due to the Con Edison, the diagnosis of paranoia was very obvious. We won't go into psychiatry tonight. Anyone who wants to know about it can find it in the book. It's easily explained. But if he, beside this stilted language, the grammar and the syntax were impeccable, and I felt that he was somewhere around, had at least 2 years of high school education, which was correct. Now, if he was a paranoiac, he would be meticulous, he would have a mind as sharp as a razor, and he certainly fooled the police for 16 years. He would be stilted in his manner, he would not be sociable, but if you said good morning to him, he would say good morning and even go you one better by throwing in a smile. He would be neat, he would be dressed very effectively, but not showily. He would not wear a beard or any facial adornment or jewelry. Now, since it was obvious that as a paranoiac, and with this other facts that I'm about to present you, that he was infantile in his emotional development, he would not have no friends at all. And, of course, as a paranoiac, we know from the work of Kretschmer in Germany and Sheldon here that he was athletic in build, which does not mean he's a bruiser, but that his body type is a symmetrical kind. He was, of course, shrewd enough not to mail his letters from his hometown, but he did have them postmarked as Westchester, which, for your listeners, not New York, is the county directly above New York City and just west and adjacent to Connecticut. And I, therefore, pinpointed him to that region for the following reason. Since he used bombs and used a knife to slash the seats, I combined the two and, playing the law of averages, felt that he came somewhere from Middle Europe. And as a Middle European, if he were a Slav, that the Slavs in this country are mostly Catholic, and I pinned his religion to that, which he was, and the greatest concentration of Slavs in the northeast part of the United States is in southwestern Connecticut, and it would be easy for him to go across the state border to mail his letters. I was correct in that. He did come from Waterbury, Connecticut, and he was a Roman Catholic. Now, his letters were remarkably and amazingly neat and very well printed. They were absolutely uniform with one very small exception, and that is he didn't print the letter W as a double V, but as an actual W. This has the psychosexual symbolism of either the female breast, the male genitalia, or both. Coupling this with the fact that he slashed the underside of motion picture seats, this also has a psychosexual implication of either penetrating the mother or emasculating the father or both, but the both facts certainly point to a man who craved to be back at that time of life when all of us are at the utmost in safety, which is next to the mother's breast. Therefore, of course, as an emotional infant, he would have no friends, either male or female. Now, with these things, I suggested, and a few more that are actually in the book, I suggested to Inspector Finney, who certainly was no fool, he had a master's degree in forensic psychiatry himself, that they go through the files of Con Edison. Well, Con Edison wouldn't allow this, and Inspector Finney was back in 2 weeks. I suggested then that he induce the commissioner to get his permission to publish what I had told him in the paper. If I was wrong, nothing would happen. If I was right, we'd have a bite. And incidentally, just before the inspector and his two assistants left, I felt I might as well be hung for a whale as well as a minnow. I said, Inspector, you're never going to catch this man by detection. He's too clever. He believes he's God. But as such, while he is all-powerful and has fooled everybody, he knows it, but nobody else does. I think he is bursting to tell you the news, and when you find him, he will be graciously welcoming and just delighted to see you, and he probably will be wearing a double-breasted coat, and it'll be buttoned. Well, the inspector and his two men looked at each other. I knew what they were thinking. This shrink needs a shrink. But they did get the commissioner to permission to publish it in the paper, and a little girl in the personnel office of Con Edison went broop through the file. She came up with the name of George Metesky. They went up there and they knocked at the door. He answered. And he said, yes, gentlemen. They said, we're from the New York Police Department. He smiled. He said, why, I've been waiting for you. And that night, Inspector Finney called me. He said, we got our man. Well, I said, congratulations. He said, don't you dare hang up. I want to know how you knew that he would be wearing a double-breasted coat. I said, that doesn't worry me. I'm concerned whether it was buttoned or not. He said, you knew darn well it was. Now tell me why. Well, I said, you know psychiatry that much, that since this man was a paranoiac and would be neat and tidy and always... No, I said, since you know psychiatry, and that this man was craving to be back at his mother's bosom, what is more symbolic of the bosom than the double-breasted suit? And as a paranoiac, since he's neat and tidy, meticulous, and always impeccable and correct, of course would have to be buttoned, and that's how simple it is.
Doctor, how do you link a crime with that type of man who would commit that sort of crime?
How do you make a what?
How do you link a crime with the type of man who would commit that sort of crime?
Well, to begin with, the crime had to be committed as an expression of hostility, and hostility always indicates a paranoid type of mind or a paranoiac. They both have hatred in their soul. It dates back invariably to their earliest time in life, childhood certainly, in which they have some sort of unresolved grudge, either because they had love and were deprived of it, or never had it. There's a brush off, there's a rejection. It's simply an individual that never develops and goes through his usual psychosexual development normally. He's simply been hungry for that which he just doesn't have.
What made you believe that the Boston Strangler crimes were committed by one man?
Well, to begin with, the thing that induced the others to think that there were two and even three was the fact that the age limit of the age bracket, rather, of the victims ran from 70s down to 20s. And all along, I will admit, I had a hunch that this was done by one man, but I had to prove it, not for their satisfaction, but actually my own. And it suddenly dawned on me that the older women, and they were really first, represented his mother, who had really never given him love. We know that from his family history, which I obtained not only from him but others. And he settled her hash in his unconscious, and then when he turned to the younger women, he was turning to the women of his age, who, mind you, didn't give him love. It wasn't sex that he was not getting. He had plenty of that, but he was never getting love. Now, that was number one. Number two was the fact that here was a case in which every single woman had certainly one thing in common. They all had a serene expression in death. To me, this meant that none of them expected to be strangled, and the only way they would know that would be to turn their back to him as they let him into their apartments. And, of course, that also told me how he got into the apartments. It wasn't as a human fly or any trick mechanism. He had just walked through the door. Now, with their back to him, of course, this triggered instantly in him his hatred that he had for these women, because turning their back represented the brush off. And all he did was to throw his arm around their neck, and it is a physiological fact that pressure on the internal carotid artery and the jugular vein, that's the blood supply to and from the brain, in 2 to 3 seconds, which is really a trice, induces unconsciousness. They're not dead, of course, but from then on, they never did come to life again. Then there was another thing that I've simply got to say is psychosexual evidence, which those in your audience who are interested will have to read it in the book. We can't say it over the air, which indicated to me that this man achieved in 18 months what the rest of us achieve from birth to puberty, that is, his psychosexual development. And I knew it was one man, and then when I did stick my neck out, that's when all the experts went home and left me. I said he has committed 13 murders, and the evidence on the last one indicates that he has resolved his emotional difficulty. He will never kill anyone again. And that was true.
This is Night Call in New York. Tonight our conversation is a new book, The Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist by Dr. James Brussel. It's the Book of the Month Club alternate selection this month. And a reminder to our listeners that we welcome your comments as well as your conversation. And our telephone number is here in New York, area code 212-749-3311. That's if you're calling from the East or the Midwest. That's area code 212-749-3311. If you're calling from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. That's area code 212-749-3357. And if you're calling us locally from New York, it's 866-5010. That's 866-5010. We'll take our first call tonight from Bloomington, Indiana. Mr. Williams is hearing Night Call over WFIU-FM. Mr. Williams?
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, my question is, I observe that, as usual, the solutions to these sort of crimes are not all that difficult. That is, much of what has been explained, it follows very logically in all this. And while none of us should be probably necessarily acquainted with the full gamut of psychiatric terminology and all the symptoms, nevertheless, it seems fairly consistent that when a crime is committed by somebody and you find everybody being surprised until you ask them, well, did you notice anything strange beforehand? And then, by gosh, they'll tell you that, for about the last 3 years, he's been gradually changing his habits until he's a complete freak, and yet they still tell you that, no, they didn't notice anything strange. And I would wonder if anything is being done to help educate people in just plain observing. That is, I suspect we have to start with the rather defunct educational system and have them teach perception rather than just filling the brain pan full of facts. But is there any effort being expended to try to educate the public to just merely observe each other and take note?
All right, Mr. Williams, can I answer that?
Yes.
I cannot answer for the 50 state jurisdictions and the many large cities in this country, but I can tell you what is being done, and for the past quite a few years has been done, by the largest mental hygiene organization in the world, which is the New York State Department of Hygiene. We have I wrote one of the pamphlets, and that was at least 18 years ago, 19 years ago. We have been putting out pamphlets. Number one, this is for the normal individual, what to look for and what to do in each period of life from infancy to old age. Number two, to acquaint people with the potential and inalterable benefits of prevention. That's the way it is. To look for these early signs that Mr. Williams is speaking about. We have the famous artist who creates Blondie and is a good friend of ours, who does a yearly almanac comic book for us on this subject, so that is presented very well and is most suitable for school children, both elementary and high school, and incidentally for adults. We hold orientation lectures in our various institutions and our various clinics for the public. The New York Academy of Medicine holds meetings two or three times a year for the general public to come in to learn how to detect and look for ominous signs, warning signs, so that any emotional or mental catastrophe can be nipped in the bud. The stitch in time saves nine, so forth, that idea. I know we are doing that, and I feel most positive that other states are doing it. I can't answer for all of them, but those are some of the things we are doing.
Okay, I appreciate that. I'm glad there's something being done, because it's, for example, I, being a blind person, am very... my world is of a slightly different proportion.
That's true, but you are probably more sensitive to certain changes that a sighted person is not.
Yeah, and I, for example, in voices, I can tell you probably almost the general plan of the future for most people just by listening to them talk for a while.
That's right, because your four remaining senses are compensating and are more acute than the sighted person.
And it seems to me if I can do that, people with even, that other people ought to be able to also, and, it's just a matter of common sense, I would think.
That's right, and we're trying our best it's to propagandize and to educate, and I agree with you that we probably can do more, but in our fumbling way, we hope to get there.
Well, Mr. Williams, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Dr. Brussel, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest crime psychiatrist Dr. James Brussel after station identification.
Because I happen to be black, every once in a while someone asks me what I really want. Well, the answer is simple enough. I want what every wife and mother wants. I want a job for my husband so I can stay home and mind the children. I want the prices in the stores in my neighborhood to be the same as anywhere else. I want clean streets, safe streets, a place for my children to play. I want my children to have the same chance at a good education as other children, so they'll have a chance at a better life than I've had. If I wanted any less for my family than other mothers want, what kind of mother would I be?
It isn't easy to get by in the cities these days. For blacks or whites, our cities need help, your help. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder. Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest crime psychiatrist James Brussel about why criminals behave the way they do. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we continue with our conversation tonight, why criminals behave the way they do, and our guest calling in tonight is Dr. James A. Russell, the author of a book called Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist, and we'll take a local call. This time, Mr. Thompson is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM here in New York. Mr. Thompson?
Yes, this is he speaking.
Good evening, sir. Your question?
I'd like to address my question to Mr. James Russell.
Yes.
Mr. Russell?
Dr. Russell, yes.
Dr. Russell?
Yeah.
In 1947, I was picked up for a crime which I did not commit. And I was sent to Bellevue for observation. Yeah. And as a result of that, I was tried, convicted, and I'd done 13 years and 9 months at Sing Sing, Greenhaven, and Dannemora. And as a result of that time, I came out blind, and I'm blind now. And doing this interview with this psychiatrist at Bellevue, they gave a report that I was moderate or celery, you know. And I don't really think...
You were what?
I don't really think that a psychiatrist or psychologist or anyone else can really tell about a person's mind. He may, in some instances, make good guesses. Mm-hmm. Maybe 75 to 85% of the time. Mm-hmm. But after doing 13 years and 9 months and hearing a lot of stories... And I knowing my own case better than anybody else in the world, though I worked on it all the time I was in there. As a matter of fact, I'm working on it now, trying to prove that I'm innocent. I've even talked to the governor about it. How do you account for the fact that I went before these psychiatrists, they asked me different questions, I told the truth, and yet I did 13 years and 9 months for it?
Well, number
they,
one...
They put me in a certain category.
Number one, all right, I mean, should I answer you?
Yes, sir.
All right. Number one is, I am the last one, and I don't think any of my colleagues would either, to make the claim that psychiatry is infallible. And number two, no, have we ever claimed that psychiatry is of itself a science? It is an art, though they do resort to the use of scientific apparatus and scientific tests. Now, as a matter of fact, if, as you say, I have no reason to doubt you, I don't know you.
Right.
That you are absolutely innocent, that you were wrongly convicted.
Definitely.
You definitely have a case for retribution, for correction, and...
That's almost impossible, Doctor.
Well, now, wait. For instance, the Legal Aid Society, if they see any justification, will take up your case. As a matter of fact, there is a group in this country headed by Rex Stout, the very famous mystery writer, who has taken up cases such as yours and gone to bat for them, and he's got a string of remarkable successes to his credit. So that your court of last resort is not unattainable. You can get it.
Yes, listen, it. You hear one case out of 1,000. It is publicized. Everyone, like yourself, have the uppermost confidence in it. In 1953, as a result of a letter that I wrote to the district attorney here in Manhattan, I was sent for, and I was kept down to the city prison, which is 100 Center Street. However, I stayed sick quite a bit with my eyes, and I was frequently sent over to Bellevue for cortisone treatments and, you know, et cetera. And I even gave him the name. The boy in the penitentiary named the person. He told me that he had committed a crime. I talked to the district attorney. You know what he'd done? Nothing. You know why they didn't do anything? Well, let me tell you why. Because they felt that if they had made a mistake and I was able to prove it, they would have to pay me for every day that I spent in the penitentiary.
Well, they have made mistakes and paid, I can tell you that.
The legal aid, I spoke with the legal aid. I even wrote to Adam Clayton Powell during the time that he was in office. I even went to the NAACP, wrote to them. I even went before the Baptist Convention at 146th Street and Convent Avenue. I even sit out here on 125th Street blind with petitions, asking people to sign. People don't even want to sign anything like that because they don't want to get involved. And they didn't do anything about it. And when the governor finally visited Harlem, which was this summer, I finally got a chance to speak to him. He promised to do something. I haven't heard anything since.
Well, I am in the Department of Hygiene, of course, not the Department of Law. And, of course, your original gripe is with the city of New York, and I'm not connected with the city. I'm connected with the state. But I can only tell you that that the Legal Aid Society is your best bet, and of course, you could appeal also to the state attorney general at 80 Center Street.
And do you really sincerely and honestly believe that they would admit after thorough investigation?
It's been done, my friend. That's all I can tell you. It's been done. I can't tell you what they would do, but I know that it's been done when a mistake has been made, and then a bill has been introduced into the legislature and passed compensating the man for his lost time. It has been
done. I've heard of isolated cases. However, let me say this here, and I don't want to hold you up too long. I know there are other people that are waiting to talk with you. I have a friend that is willing to put money up as a reward, and I know, believe me, they'll come forward. But it's a case of getting someone that is really sincere in investigating the case to really be on my side. Yeah, I know that when I sat out on 125th Street, I knew that I was being investigated there by a policeman woman, because I could tell from the pertinent questions that she was asking, and she was trying to localize the crime, you know. Mm-hmm. And I knew that it was a policeman. But since I couldn't get 10,000 names, it was turning cold, and clothes was very, very few, I had to give it up.
Well, you also may try a private lawyer without going to Legal Aid Society and see if he would take it on a contingency basis. That is, if he loses, he gets nothing. If you collect, he gets a certain percentage of it. I'm sure there are many attorneys, if it's a valid case, they will take it on that grounds.
Mr. Thompson?
Well, I'll try there.
Right.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you so very kindly for accepting the call. Good
Thank
night.
You, sir. This is Night Call in New York, our conversation, Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do. Our guest calling in is the author of Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist. Our guest is Dr. James A. Brussell. This time out to Camden, New Jersey, Mrs. Johnson is hearing Night Call of WHAT. Mrs. Johnson?
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Russell. I'll be short. I'm going to be very long. I'd like to know something. I'd like for him to answer it. I got 7 kids, and we raised them good. We teach them about God and the Bible and all, what's right and what's wrong. My husband, ordained deacon. And we're a young couple. My husband's 27, I'm 24. But this is the problem I have. My kids go to school. My son Eugene has an undercurrent or something, I don't know. When he gets to the school, he explodes. He won't do his work. He cusses his teacher. He absolutely refuses to cooperate. Now I'm having a problem here at home. I tell my kids to do something, they won't mind. They know they're going to get a beating, and they do it anyhow. And they just do all kinds of things, and it's really getting me down.
Well, my suggestion right then and there is to ask your local principal, and he does have the information, to whom you can take your boy for an examination to determine his emotional status. That is, you begin at the beginning, first things first, and that is the step I suggest. That's what we do in our schools. It is working successfully, and I recommend that heartily.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do is our conversation tonight. And our guest calling in is Dr. James A. Brussell, Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist. It is the Book of the Month Club's alternate selection this month, and we certainly hope that all of our Night Call listeners will get it. We'll return to our guest, Dr. Brussell, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest crime psychiatrist Dr. James Brussell after station identification. Next week on Night Call, a black South African expert on apartheid, a Jewish expert on the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, the founder and former head of the Congress for Racial Equality, a San Francisco minister to tell us what we have to be thankful for on Thanksgiving night, and psychoanalyst Eric Fromm. Monday, South African political science professor Wynton Nagin from Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Tuesday, social worker novelist Julius Horowitz. His latest book is called WASP. Wednesday, James Farmer. Thursday, the Reverend Cecil Williams, Minister of Community Involvement for the Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco. And Friday, Eric Fromm on Hope and Love. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest crime psychiatrist James Brussel about why criminals behave the way they do. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who join us for the second half hour. Our conversation tonight, why criminals behave the way they do. And our guest is author of the Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist, Dr. James A. Brussel, calling in from New York. We'll take our first call during this half hour from Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Dansby is hearing Night Call over KTXT-FM. Mr. Dansby?
Sir?
Yes. Good evening, sir.
My roommate and I were arguing about a little point, and I was wondering if you think that anyone is capable of committing a crime, and I don't mean penny ante stuff, I mean grand larceny or murder or something.
Well, the answer to that question is, to begin with, there's the old cliche that there's a little bit of bad in all of this, just as much as there's a little bit of good and even the worst one. Whether or not anyone will commit a crime, violent or nonviolent, depends upon what we call in psychiatry the superego and what you would call the conscience. In other words, if this man has a bringing up in a family that has a high regard for right and wrong, for the mores of society, for their particular religion, and for the law of their community, the odds are that this man, even when he is wronged and justifiably feels that he is wrong, will not resort to crime, but will resort to those measures that the laws permit him to. Thus, he will sue, he will go to court, or he will challenge someone to a debate. No, it is not in everyone the capacity to commit a violent crime. It does depend on an individual's background.
I see. Then it is, you aren't born with the ability, it's more or less your environment.
Well, now, you're twisting the question around, and I'm not going to deny this, that so far as the actual sociopath or the psychopath or the criminal is concerned, we are still not convinced that it is entirely due to either his environment or bringing up. We cannot ignore the fact that there may be a constitutional factor. In other words, we are still asking the question, is he born that way or does he get that way? And that's about the most honest answer I can give you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York, why criminals behave the way they do. Our guest, Dr. James A. Brussel, author of Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist, and this time out to Amarillo, Texas. Mr. Norio is hearing Night Call over KPUR. Mr. Norio?
This is Mr. Norio, N-O-R-I-D.
Oh, Norio, I'm sorry, sir.
Correct.
Good evening.
Good evening. I'd like to ask the doctor if he has seen the movie The Boston Strangler, and if so, if it is the movie is correct, if it's a true story.
Well, I saw the movie because I was invited by 20th Century to see the preview. Now, I'm not a movie critic, but so far as the movie is concerned, it is not factual. To give you one quick example, DeSalvo was not caught by being run down by an automobile. He was caught the way I said he would be caught, and that is he would start boasting about what he had done until he got himself into the point where he had to admit it. Number two, he was never in the city, Boston City Hospital. Number three, in the motion picture, I can't think of any presentation in which psychiatry was made to look like a bigger schmo, in which the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General Mr. Bottomley, with whom I was on a program yesterday in Boston, is the man who administers or conducts what can only be called psychoanalysis, while the chief psychiatrist of the hospital stands by, shakes his head in the negative, and looks very mournful as though it's going to fail or harm the individual. No, it is not a factual film, period.
Okay, have you read the book by Gerald Frank?
Gerald Frank, I not only read the book, he mentions me 11 times in the book, and my good friend Gerald Frank wrote the introduction to my book, The Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist.
And would you recommend the book for anyone to read?
Well, I'm my own friend. I'm not going to say don't read his book, but bear one thing in mind. There was a book even written by another one, Blank in Boston, but my book, the chapters on the Boston Strangler, my book is written by the only man that has ever talked to and examined Mr. DeSalvo and then wrote a book. The others have never seen him or talked to him.
Well, it might have been mentioned before, and I didn't catch it, but how many crimes have you solved through your methods?
I can't count them because I had to. I've done them for many years. I did them in the Army, both in World War II and the Korean conflict. And, of course, I've worked on many cases with the FBI and the CID of counterespionage during the Korean conflict. But let's settle at a conservative couple of hundred.
Well, have you ever taken a case in which you have failed to solve it?
I certainly have. And believe me, I'm going to be the last one to say I'm infallible.
Mighty fine. Thank you for talking to me.
Not at all.
Thank you for calling, sir. Our conversation tonight, Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do, with our guest, Dr. James A. Russell, author of Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist. To Philadelphia, Pennsylvania next, Mr. Ballard is hearing Night Call over WHAT. Mr. Ballard?
Yes, I'd like to direct my question to the criminal psychiatrist.
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Ballard. You're talking from the city. I went to college and medical school in. Go ahead.
Right, I'd like to ask you a question. What sort of roles do black people play in criminal psychiatry?
I don't think they play any different role than they do as non-criminals in ordinary life. That they are represented, I would say, about the same way they are in the population. I don't have statistics on this, but I can tell you where you can get them, and that, of course, is from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now, these figures are not to be confused with any figures that are put out so far as drug addiction is concerned, which you can obtain from the Narcotics Administration at Lexington, Kentucky. I don't have the figures about them. I know that in the crimes that I have listed in the casebook of a crime psychiatrist, not one of them happens to be a Negro. But, of course, that doesn't mean anything too much, since not one of the cases in my book has anything to do with a gun, by the way, in this day of violence. It has to do with strangling and with stabbing and with poisoning and so forth. But for the figures that you want, if you want exact figures, you can get them from the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very
not
much.
Not at all.
Thank you for calling, sir.
All right.
Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do is our conversation tonight with Dr. James A. Russell. And let's go out to San Diego, California. Mr. Park is hearing Night Call over KOGO-FM. Mr. Park?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Yes. My question is directed to the psychologist.
I'm right here.
I've listened to your conversation so far, and the potentiality sounds like my potentiality. I mean, where you said he was meticulous and all this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can look at myself, I compare myself to him, and it seems that I have the same quality traits and everything, though I have never committed a crime or anything.
That's right.
I mean, I've had the urge to many times, and it's just, I'm just wondering, is it a repressed? Is it something that's repressed in all of us, or is it just...
No. The reason that you feel like committing a crime and then don't is what I just told a previous questioner, is that your superego or your conscience is sufficiently strong and fortified to cause you to refrain from an act which you know is socially unacceptable. But the fact that you are neat and tidy, meticulous and punctual, is incidentally, if you want to look up the literature of how this is described, is this is common to the paranoiac and the paranoid, but in the normal individual, this is simply an accentuation of what analysts call anal erotic traits. This you find very well explained and easily understood in my own book, The Layman's Guide to Psychiatry. This is a free plug at the expense of Dell.
Oh, okay.
Does that answer your question, sir?
Yeah, one of them. Yeah, I haven't heard you.
All right, next question.
Adam?
If you're trying to analyze yourself just as a potential criminal, if you would say.
Yeah.
And you...
Adam?
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
All right. If you're trying to analyze
yourself... Analyze yourself, yeah.
As a potential criminal.
Yeah.
But you look all around you and you see that your potentiality is greater than a criminal.
Yeah.
I mean, intellectually, you could see where you would where you would make a mistake or where you wouldn't and all that. Well, what keeps you from doing it?
Well,
I mean, besides the repression of an ego, I mean,
the unconscious control that your superego has, and if incidentally you resort to what you call self-analysis, Let me tell you, this is not a very successful method of investigation. Even Freud failed to do it. If you're really curious about it, and you know somebody who is well-grounded in psychology, have him do the ink blot test on you, the so-called Rorschach test, and you'll get very good insight into your personality and your potentials and your handicaps.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Why criminals behave the way they do is our conversation tonight with Dr. James A. Brussel. And let's go out to Tampa, Florida. Mrs. Lang is here in Night Call over WFLA. Mrs. Lang?
Yes?
Hello,
good evening.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the question. I know that there are many types of criminals, and most of them are motivated by their minds. I'd like to know, is there any way, or perhaps it already is, to have therapy in schools?
What is that about therapy in school?
Is there any way of having therapy in schools?
Well, if you mean as a group or individually?
Possibly as a group, possibly individually. It would depend, of course, on the need of the child.
Well, if you're talking about therapy, or you're talking about, let's say, education or elementary mental hygiene, you mean actual therapy for an ill child?
Well,
for a sick child?
Yes.
Well, I don't know what they're doing in Florida, but of course up here we do have outpatient child psychiatry clinics, perfectly free, private if you want them to, not only run by the state and the city, but even by general hospitals. They are run in by psychiatric services. They have child guidance clinics, and if you don't have that in Florida, then you've got a good cause to start working on.
No, I know that we have free mental health clinics.
Well, now, yes, but you're speaking of children.
Yes, I mean,
if you take the children, you see, it would be inadvisable to treat this child in a school. He would undergo some sort of embarrassment because his classmates would learn very quickly that he is receiving the special therapy for this rather unusual condition, and the whole treatment program may collapse as he suffers embarrassment in his own environment, in his own group. That's why these clinics are not conducted in the school. I would not favor it.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for calling, ma'am. Thank you. Night Call in New York, our conversation, Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do. And our next caller to talk to Dr. James A. Brussel is coming from Seattle, Washington. Mr. Miller is hearing Night Call over KUOWFM.
Hello, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Miller?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. I've been doing some reading in psychology lately, and there's a magazine out, a fairly new one, called Psychology.
Yes, I see it advertised.
Yes, it's a very, very good magazine.
Uh-huh.
There was a recent article, if I'm not mistaken, I think Ashley Montague was the author, on the possibility of chromosome indications of criminals, such
yeah.
as the XXY
yeah.
Type. Do you have any information on this? Would you care to comment?
Yes, the one you're speaking of is the XYY chromosome. For the benefit of the other listeners, the usual combination of the pairing is XY, and a couple of cases have recently been pleaded on the grounds of mental illness due to the finding of this extra Y chromosome. I believe that's what you're referring to.
Yes.
One was in France, and I think the other was in Australia. Is that correct?
Right.
This is not new. To begin with, about 3, 4, or 5 months ago, a couple of workers found in the chromosome arrangement of more than 300 criminals some sort of abnormality or malfunction, or rather poor structure, in, 80%, I think, of these 300. Now, what this is exactly what the pitch in my book, The Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist, is about. I am pleading that these criminals, once society's demand for protection by having them put away for life, should be collected and should be used for research, preferably in an institution established in an environment such as the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, for two reasons. One is that every scientific facility is immediately located and available there. And number two is a question of finance, which would require federal funds. And thank heaven, because there's not enough, there are not enough of these cases in each jurisdiction. Now, I'm not suggesting that even the geneticist will give us the answer, or certainly not psychiatry. I'll get us out of the picture. It may be an engineer for all I know, but at least let's do something. Now, we are speaking about these magical substances in the cell, such as DNA and RNA. Who knows that we may find some X factor, could be a chromosome, which could be, to use a very poor word, immunized in one generation so that future generations would be free of the type of mentation that results in such horrible behavior and breaking of the law as we are seeing in now and in the recent past.
Yes, I come somewhat to the same conclusion. As an added thought, I seem to remember something on this population that they've found with this type of chromosome defect seems to be of over average height and has several physical features which are easily recognizable. However, you can't pick a person out of a crowd, obviously, and say, well...
That's right. But exactly what you're saying is only the beginning of what I would like to see as research. Investigate every possible angle, even if it's to the size of his shoe or how many gold teeth he had. I'm deliberately sounding silly to illustrate the point that there is no end to the possible research available for us.
Yes.
Mr. Miller, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Dr. James A. Brussell, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest crime psychiatrist Dr. James Brussell after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, homosexuals and the law. Just what rights do these particular consenting adults have, or should they have? Is there a reasonable base for the population's fear of homosexuality? How can you deal with it, or even accept it, when it occurs in your own family? Or when it is on a large enough scale to be publicly obvious in your own community? Our guest for this special edition of Night Call is an anonymous attorney, a member of the Mattachine Society, an organization of American homosexuals. Anonymous to protect his rights by hiding his true face from a society that will not accept him for what he is. Homosexuals and the Law, with an anonymous attorney from the Mattachine Society, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest crime psychiatrist James Brussell about why criminals behave the way they do. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our conversation tonight, Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do, with our guest, Dr. James A. Brussell, author of the Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist. And let's go out to Washington, D.C. Mr. Rosenwald is hearing Night Call over WAMU.
Oh, yes, Mr. Rosenwald.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I would like you to give me your opinion. What do you think of the personality of Lee Harvey Oswald and about the murder of President Kennedy?
Well, the personality, the first thing that I must say to you, and I'm not dodging the question, is I try to avoid crystal ball gazing and diagnosing sight unseen. If to render you an opinion on the personality, even on his mental state, I would have to, of course, examine and talk to myself. However, we must at least admit it's so obvious, of course, that he did resort to psychopathic behavior. Now, whether or not the man was psychotic, I can't answer you, because the first thing I would like to see done would be psychological inquiry, such as the inkblot test, perhaps the somatic apperception test, and I can name a dozen, and then I would like to question him, and even in a case like this, perhaps subject him to electroencephalography and see what the tracing shows. I can't tell you honestly what it is. The fact that he was married could mean something. It does mean something. The fact that he rejected this country, went over to Russia, rejected that country, whether he was put out or not, I'll never know, and came back here. You see, all these factors have to be known. I can't make a glib diagnosis or a glib estimate, as so many armchair psychiatrists seem able to do, and I do bow to their superiority.
All right, I was assuming, since in some cases where you probably had fewer data than the data just mentioned, you came to correct conclusions.
Well, yes, and you say there's even fewer facts known, but at least if I have the chance myself to make an examination, I can arrive at a reasonable impression, even perhaps a rather exact diagnosis. But you're asking me to render you an opinion on some rather glib statements that appeared in the paper and an hysterical press at the time, understandably, and I don't have that real superior knack to do that.
Yeah.
Mr. Roosevelt, okay, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Our conversation tonight on Night Call, Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do, with Dr. James A. Russell, and this time up to Utica, New York, Mr. Kobus is hearing Night Call over WRUN. Mr. Kobus?
Hello.
You calling from Court Street in Utica?
No, not Court Street.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm calling from, in reference to the previous question, could you comment on Jack Ruby and his motives? There was plenty of time to examine him.
Well, there was plenty of time, but I didn't examine him.
You didn't?
No, of course not. And not only that, but in a case like that, incidentally, in answer to your question and Mr. Rosenwald, there are even certain, and here we go for something scientific, I would like to know what we call a serology, that is, what a blood test, if any, if it were done on Ruby, showed. I want to know, in view of the size of his bill, did he have any organic deficiency or malfunction? I would also want to know precisely what his family life was like. I would like to know what his IQ is. I'd like to know if he had any kind of a criminal record. I don't mean whether was he a felony, but whether, for instance, repeated misdemeanors. You see, these are some of the things, and by far not all of them, that I would like to know. Perhaps I lack something that I just can't give you a snap impression, but I can't do it. I did not examine him.
Oh, okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. Why Criminals Behave the Way They Do is our conversation tonight with Dr. James A. Brussel. And Dr. Brussel, if I may for a moment return to your book,
yep,
The Casebook of a Crime Psychiatrist.
I love it. I love it.
In the case of Janice Wiley and Emily Huffin.
Oh, I knew you'd get around to that.
Well, where a confession was made by the convicted killer, you've stated that you contend that the real murderer is still at large.
Well, let me put it to you this way, and this is a little bit of a scoop for your station. In the last week, I have spoken, and I'm not even going to say he's or she's, to four different people, all of them well-educated, well-trained. I have had one, by the way, a psychiatrist who was interested in the case. I have had some amazing material turned into me, even by a very well-educated, well-employed, reliable citizen who is a relative of the accused, some startling material that has apparently either unknown to the police or ignored, but all of us come to the same conclusion that Mr. Robles, the accused, does not fit the picture. Now, to give you a few reasons, to begin with, the crime was committed on a beautiful, clear, warm day in August. It was around the noon hour, 1 o'clock. At the time I first went into the case, the Lieutenant Wendell at the time, he's now deceased, he agreed with me that the man who did the killings came to that specific apartment. He walked in the door. Now, any man who is going to commit burglary in the daytime, when he plays Russian roulette with doorbells, he is looking for one that does not answer. There were some tenants at home all that day, and 2 hours on either side of that hour, their buzzer did not sound, so that we contend the man who went there knew where he was going. Now, the accused was dressed that day in a rather disreputable sports shirt, sloppy slacks and sneakers, and he certainly, in that posh East Side luxury apartment neighborhood, would certainly be noticed, whereas my candidate, who I say is symmetrically built and neatly and nattily and stylishly dressed, and I even throw in a dispatch case to make it really look high class, would not be noticed. He simply lacks the education and the mentality to get away with it, as it were. Number two, the claim in his alleged confession that he talked to the girl, that she readily acquiesced to his request for sex, and thereafter indulged in the wildest type of sexual shenanigans, is contrary to the fact of a drug addict who is hooked on heroin, because heroin suppresses all drive. And if he has no heroin in him, he sure has a drive, and that is to get more drugs. And if he's after more drugs and hasn't got the money, then his drive is to get the money. Now, the pictures and the description of the disturbed and disarrayed living room that the police showed me indicated, according to them, that the disarray was not that which you see when a burglar is looking for something and nothing was stolen, but one in which there's a scuffle or a chase. Now, there are many other factors. They're all in the book. And when my questions are rebutted successfully, I'll be the first one to shout, "I'm wrong," and I won't blush.
Doctor, we'll take our next call from Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. May is hearing Night Call over WTLC-FM.
Right.
Mr. May?
Yes.
Good evening,
Mr. May.
Sir.
How are you?
How are you?
Am I speaking to Dr. Brussel?
Yep.
Dr. Brussel?
Yeah.
Are you on? I have been listening to your conversation, and I have never heard you mention anything concerning hypnosis. Is there a possibility that maybe through the use of...
I can answer your question, because that came up in the Coppolino trial, if you'll read it in the book. And I will tell you this about hypnosis and about truth serum. You cannot use any agent to induce, let's say you have a criminal who has committed a crime. You cannot induce a criminal to reveal anything which his unconscious feels is jeopardizing his safety and security any more than you could have anyone who has not committed a crime reveal, let's say, quote, a secret, quote, the revelation of which would embarrass them, which would ruin them. If you could do this, I assure you that the law would have been changed many years ago to use it. And, of course, if you could use hypnosis to have people do things against their will, generals centuries ago would have had entire armies hypnotized to ignore death and to march forward against the enemy. Of course, I would like to see two such armies meet each other, and that's exactly what I said in the Coppolino trial in New Jersey.
May I disagree with you for a moment?
All right, you may, of course.
What you said so far is true, right to a T. But isn't there a possibility that under hypnosis, even though that you cannot get a person to divulge a secret,
yeah,
or to go against their moral or religious belief, you could make them do something, whether it be raise a finger or to act a certain way so that you will know that they are not telling you.
Right. I'll tell you one good way you can do it is the Rorschach test will reveal a man who is lying. There is one other way, and I was a pioneer in that, and that is to use a substance known as methedrine, which is exactly the same stuff, a substance that's an amphetamine, which the drug addicts have called speed and goofballs and so forth. This forces an individual, while conscious, to speak faster and faster and faster because it's very stimulating until he gets to the point when you fire machine gun fashion questions at him so fast that he cannot censor his thoughts and you trip him up. And as a matter of fact, if you'll just wait patiently, next year you're going to see this on the television series that I'm writing. And that's a plug.
I see. Well, can I say just one other thing?
Yeah.
Now, I took a course on hypnosis on an educational basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I am of the belief, according to the people that I took it for, it was from Indiana University, that this hypnosis might be the key to a lot of the problems of the criminal mind, of the would-be criminals, of the people who seem normal, but by some quirk of fate causes them to do other than what they should do.
Well, wait, let me just get one thing in there, though. You know, of course, that you cannot have anyone submit to a truth serum, to hypnosis, unless they willingly sign for...
Dr. Brussel, Mr. May, thank you so much.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. May. Dr. Brussel, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
My pleasure to be here.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, Homosexuals and the Law, with an anonymous attorney from the Mattachine Society, an organization of American homosexuals. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.